And so when we talk about a soft landing, the Fed's talking about the economy per se, so GDP, employment, those kinds of things, not the financial markets. So, you know, I think the financial markets are in for a hard landing.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. Suddenly, talk of an approaching recession is everywhere. And while it's a risk I've been warning of for quite a while now, voices from the establishment, like Goldman Sachs Chair Lloyd Blankfein and former Federal Reserve Vice Chairs Richard Clarida and Randall Quarles, have recently joined the chorus. But while a recession may indeed lie ahead, it's not staring us in the face just yet, says macro analyst Wolf Richter. Here, he'll walk us through the data to help us better gauge when a recession could arrive. Wolf, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me back, Adam.
Wolf, it's always great. All right, lots to get into with you, but let's just kick off with our regular, very high-level question. What is your current assessment of today's global economy and financial markets?
Well, I still see, in terms of the U.S. economy, I still see the most overstimulated economy ever. And after, you know, $4.7 trillion of money printing by the Fed and about $6 trillion worth of deficit spending by the federal government of just the past 2 years. And some of this money has been spent and some of this money is still sitting around in large quantities waiting to be spent at all levels. So governments, various state and local governments, businesses and consumers are still flush with cash and they're spending it, you know, and we're seeing that. And now the economy globally, it varies. You know, China has a significant problem right now. There are bigger issues in Europe and in some other places, the economy is doing pretty well. So, the world has diverged a little bit, especially with the lockdowns in China causing massive problems and with the slow motion demise of the property development sector in China. But that's different from what we're facing here in the United States. We've got 11.5 million job openings that businesses have trouble filling. And we've got wages going up because companies can't really hire one, can have trouble hiring people. And so we're not looking at a recession scenario today. That's not what it is. We still have an incredibly overstimulated economy.
All right. So if I can sort of summarize that, you're saying we're still in the pig in the python part of this phase, right? Where the central planners crammed about $11 trillion worth of stimulus into the system. And that takes a while to make its way all the way through here. Let's see. You also said...
Let me throw in a couple other things here.
Yeah.
Inflation is going to burn through some of that remaining cash that's out there. The purchasing power of that remaining cash is going to get burned up slowly, at a rate of 8 or 9% a year, you know, but it doesn't just vanish, but that has an impact on the remaining cash that's sitting out there. So that the purchasing power isn't going to remain stable. So part of it is getting burned up by inflation and part of it is just going to contribute to economic growth.
Okay. All right. So I want to get to economic growth because we're seeing, I would say, an increasing amount of signs that, the rate of economic growth is slowing. It may still be robust in certain areas, you were saying. And what's interesting, and I want to get into this because you just wrote about this. We had a negative GDP print in Q1 of this year, which somebody would say is a massive, you know, warning flag. Hey, you know, the economy is now shrinking. Your piece said, hey, that was a one-off. I think you used the term freak event. Can you explain why?
Yeah, so what didn't cause it was consumer spending. Yeah, consumer spending rose 2.7% in Q1 annualized. And that's right in the range, in the middle of the range of the pre-pandemic year. So which ranged from close to 0% to 4.5%. So that was right in the range. And so consumer spending growth has normalized. It's come down from the ridiculously high levels during the stimulus period. So it's not normalizing. And So we expected that. Consumer spending is shifting from goods to services. We knew it would happen. It happened a little later, but it's not happening on a large scale. So consumer spending on goods is declining, but consumer spending on services, which is most of what they spend the money on, is rising sharply. And so that's not where that's coming from. Where that's coming from, the decline in GDP in Q1 was a massive, and I call it freak, trade deficit. And that trade deficit, we've had issues with trade and supply chains for close to 2 years now. And Q1 was one, not just Q1, you know, this has been going on quarter after quarter that consumers have bought goods, many of which have to be imported. So the trade deficit grew and grew. What happened in Q1 is that consumers actually cut back on purchasing of goods, but companies were able to restock their inventories. And inventories are still woefully low. I mean, they're still way too low. There's all kinds of shortages out there still. And new car lots are essentially empty still. And, you know, I can't get my BMX and manufacturers can't get chips. And it's just a mess. But it's gotten a little better. And inventories on an inflation adjusted basis have come up. And that's where a lot of the imports went. And so as consumers are cutting back on spending on goods, and inventories are recovering, the import part will start to recede a little bit. So we'll still have a huge trade deficit, but it won't be so abysmally huge. And that will be a much smaller drag on GDP. We got to remember exports add to GDP and imports subtract from GDP. So if you have a trade deficit, that subtracts from GDP. And so the numbers were just gigantic in Q1. And on top of the it's $192 billion annualized at the trade deficit. And given that the GDP was negative by 70 billion, if that drawdown had been half as big from the trade deficit, which would have still been a huge trade deficit, it would have turned GDP positive. So I don't think we're going to see a repeat of that. I think Q2 is already showing up as being a slight reduction in the trade in goods. And we're seeing further trade problems with China being locked down. So that's going to reduce imports somewhat. And there's just a less demand for goods in the United States. So I don't think that this freak show that we had in Q1 about the trade deficit, it's just gigantic. I mean, it just exploded, this trade deficit. And I don't think that's going to repeat itself. That's going to normalize and still be a huge trade deficit, but not so gigantic. And that will remove much of the drag on GDP in Q2.
Okay, so we had this abnormally high trade deficit that dragged down GDP. You think, hey, it's not going to repeat twice. It's kind of this freak event. You mentioned that consumer spending actually has been holding up, that it grew 2.5% in Q1. And consumer spending is something like 67% or something like that of GDP, right?
In Q1, it was 70.5%.
Okay.
And that's kind of an interesting number because it shows how much the economy in Q1, the GDP part has shifted towards consumers because the trade deficit took so much out of it. Normally, you're right. Normally, it's in the 67% range, 68%. But because consumers have been so stimulated throughout the pandemic, they have assumed a larger portion of GDP, consumer spending. And in Q1, it hit 70.5%, which was in line with the prior record. So this is kind of an important observation, how much consumer spending has actually contributed to GDP.
All right. So in that same report, you mentioned consumers are holding up for now, and there is still an unspeakably huge amount of money floating around out there among consumers, businesses, and governments at the state and local levels after the $11 trillion in stimulus in 2 years. You mentioned the numbers earlier, $4.7 trillion in monetary stimulus, $6 trillion in government deficit spending. And then you say, and some of this money will get spent over the next few quarters. So, what I hear you saying is just, hey, whether you think it's, the right thing or not, there's still enough of this stimulus pig passing through the python that we're likely going to have a few more quarters of positive GDP growth, and don't let Q1's numbers scare you that that's kind of a head fake. One last thing about this report, you talked about that even though consumer spending grew, that purchases of goods is diminishing, but it's being made up for in purchases of services. Can you explain why that shift is going on?
Yeah, so spending on discretionary services has totally collapsed during the pandemic. And so here we're talking about airfares and cruises and entertainment events and sports events and discretionary healthcare services such as, you know, going to the dentist and elective surgery and all those kinds of things. And it just totally collapsed. And that is recovering. And we're still not back to where we were, but there's a lot of demand for domestic flying. International flights are still down. Business travel is still down, but consumers are flying for leisure at record amounts. Their hotel fares and all that is, hotel rates are going up because there's huge demand for hotels. There are rental cars, huge demand for rental cars. This is all happening right now. People are traveling, they're going to events, they're going back to the doctor, they're getting their teeth fixed, you know. So we have seen a large scale increase in services spending, but it remains way below pre-pandemic trend. Now we've reached the level of service spending from February 2020. So we're back where we were on an inflation adjusted basis before the pandemic. But when you look at the trend line, we're far below the trend line still. So services spending is going to continue to revert to the mean of the trend. And that will take several more quarters or a bunch more quarters to get there. And some of these services are not necessarily even impacted by recessions, such as healthcare services. So, that is something I see continuing to strengthen. You know, the service spending is that's going to go up. And since it's such a big part of the economy, that will support it for quite a while.
Okay. So there's a bit of, there's the monetary pig still going through the python, and you're saying, and we're now at the point pandemic wise, where the sort of opening up factor is also adding, you know, tailwind here, where finally people are saying, all right, you know what, I'm not hiding in my house anymore. I'm allowed to go out. I'm going to take that flight. I'm going to take that cruise. I'm going to go back to the hospital and get these elective surgeries done, all that type of stuff. All right. Well, look, so why I think today's topic is so important, Wolf, is it's easy to get caught up, and I'll admit I'm guilty of this at times, in looking at the macro data and projecting ahead and saying, all right, you know, it's pretty easy to make an argument that economic growth is going to be slower and lower, you know, over the next year. And I think what your data is saying, that might be true, that might be so in the long run, but don't bet the farm on it all happening tomorrow, because there's this strength that still needs time to make its way through the system here. So I want to switch to some of these big macro forces that we talk a lot about here. Number one being demand destruction, right? So, you know, classic statement about inflation is the cure for high prices is high prices, right? And we're already beginning to see that in certain areas. Some of the supply side issues are beginning to get addressed a little bit. We're beginning to see that in used car prices beginning to come down now. But the Fed has basically said, look, we're going to war against demand, right? And they've laid out their projected rate hikes for the year. Every time Powell gets in front of a camera, he says, I'm super duper serious about this. We're now having a lot of people come on and warn about recession. I just mentioned a few folks like Blankfein at the beginning of the intro here. Let's start with the Fed and their tightening. Yields have come up in advance of the Fed's interest rate hikes, but the Fed is now beginning to deliver on their own interest rate hikes here. How much impact do you think that's going to have? And what do you think the timeline is going to be until we see those impacts?
And it's interesting with the interest rate hikes because they don't directly impact the economy. Yeah, it's the economic participants' reaction to those interest rate hikes that will eventually change the equation. And so one sector that's going to be heavily impacted is housing. Consumer spending, probably less so, because credit cards are always at usurious rates. And so whether the Fed raises by 1 or 2 percentage points doesn't really make a huge difference. People who borrow at 25 or 30%, I don't really care what the Fed is doing. In terms of housing will be impacted. The credit card spending will not be impacted by that. Auto loans may be impacted by that to some extent. There's much bigger issues in the auto industry, especially in the new vehicle industry, because you can't really get the cars that you want. I mean, there's another thing there. You know, we've had this shortage of inventory, and new vehicle sales have essentially plunged to 1970s levels since April 2021, last year, you know, and because of shortages. So a lot of people that weren't in the market to buy a car haven't bought one yet, and they're going to buy one eventually. And this is the so-called pent-up demand. And when inventory starts building up and prices are starting to be at sticker or maybe below sticker again, these people will come out of the woodwork and buy a car. And I don't think 2 or 3 percentage point higher financing rates for cars are going to make a huge difference there. I mean, it's the inventory problem that's the biggest issue. But there's some downward pressure from that. And then the big thing, I think, will be in terms of asset prices. The Fed is going after asset prices. That is one of the ways that the wealth effect works. You know, it used QE and interest rate repression to pump up asset prices, which generate some consumption, which goes into GDP, you know, because people feel wealthy and they start spending some of this money from the equity in the home. They extract it via we have cash out refis or refinancing to lower mortgage payments. And so you have this whole, when asset prices are going up, you have this whole thing about some of this increase in asset prices getting converted into consumption. And now we have the opposite. So asset prices are going down. The Fed is targeting the wealth effect. It's going to be the reverse wealth effect. And people feel less confident. They're going to put that $200,000 remodel project on hold, and they're gonna not buy that $100,000 pickup truck. And maybe they're doing a few other things differently that they would have done. Maybe it's gonna be a cheaper vacation rather than blowing a bunch of money at luxury hotels. And so it percolates through the economy a little bit. And it's that the wealth effect is based on that famous trickle-down theory that you make the wealthy wealthier and some of this will trickle down. And it, you know, to some extent it works. It creates the biggest wealth disparity ever, you know, but it does trickle down a little bit. And so now we have the opposite happening. The wealth disparity is coming down, it's being diminished. And the trickle-down effect is, you know, there's less trickling down. And so that also puts pressure on demand, usually on high-end items. So you're talking about expensive cars, you're talking about yachts and those kinds of things and expensive vacations. But there are a lot of people that work in these industries, and so there'll be less demand in these industries. We've already seen layoffs in the mortgage business, a whole slew of layoffs because refis have just collapsed. And you don't need all these people working them. And so there's this impact on asset prices and on rates from asset prices and rates onto consumption that goes that way. And I think that will probably be the biggest factor in slowing down the economy is just to reverse the wealth effect. And you know, you can do that without creating a lot of havoc in the actual economy. And there will be, it will not impact as many people as it would impact if you tried to go after consumption at the lower levels of the income spectrum. And so, you know, this is the Fed strategy. You know, this is where it hopes to accomplish a soft landing in that it's bringing down asset prices, hoping to undo the trickle down effect on demand, and that will have a relatively muted impact on employment, but there will be a little bit maybe increase in unemployment. And so I mean that's the goal. I think that's what the Fed is trying to do, with quantitative tightening, that's, you know, that's what you're doing. You're going after asset prices, and you know, that will lower asset prices will put downward pressure on inflation through somewhat lower consumption at the high end.
All right. So so lower asset prices in the financial markets, you know, that disproportionately hurts the top 10%. And the reason why I say that is because they own like 80% of all the financial assets, right? So as much as we obsess over the stock market, it's not super material directly to a huge chunk of America because they just don't own that many financial assets. Going after housing obviously hits more people. But also, as you talk about this sort of just general negative wealth, this general negative wealth effect going on, it does have economic impacts, right? As people tighten their purse strings, they spend less. And as they spend less, the, you know, economy slows or, you know, potentially could shrink, and there are layoffs. And then once people start losing their jobs, they get even more fiscally conservative and whatnot. So you sort of laid out the Fed's goal here of a soft landing. What probability do you give a soft landing outcome versus a hard landing outcome? Do you think it's more likely or less likely?
And so when we talk about a soft landing, the Fed's talking about the economy per se, so GDP, employment, those kinds of things, not the financial markets. So, you know, I think the financial markets are in for a hard landing. Yeah, the soft landing, that's the best case scenario, would be, you know, a softish landing, as Powell now says, like a freshish clams. it would probably mean a very mild short recession. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with the recession. It's a natural part of the business cycle. And we used to have them, and it cleans up a lot of the excesses, and the zombie companies restructure their debts and investors take the losses. And afterwards, you know, the economy is less burdened with debt. I mean, that's a big thing about a recession. It gets rid of debt at the expense of investors. And, you know, we really need one.
It gets rid of bad debt at the expense of investors.
Yeah, it gets rid of the zombie debt, you know, that keeps getting rolled over during the good times. But during bad times, the investors finally have to take the loss. And these companies emerge with less debt. And so there can be, that's why you have these significant periods of growth after recessions, because there's less debt out there. And I don't fear a mild recession. You know, we should have had a big recession that should have let it go after the financial crisis, that shouldn't have bailed out a lot of these companies, you know, and it would have really prepared the economy for a much better growth for the following years, and then we didn't get that. So now the corporate sector is heavily indebted. I mean, it's just enormously indebted. And some of that will come home to roost. And, you know, it's investors that own this money and this debt. And they're paid to take these risks. They're paid to take the losses. I don't see any problem with that. You know, I mean, this thing needs to correct and inflation needs to come down. And if it takes a mild recession to do it, we've got all kinds of, mechanisms in the economy that support the unemployed people that lose their jobs. It's not like the Great Depression where there was nothing, you know, and so when you get laid off, you get unemployment. Yeah, you get less than you would, but you still get some spending money. And so we have these balancing mechanisms, and it's not the end of the world. So I think if the Fed gets to achieve a softish landing, meaning a mild recession, and if that solves the inflation problem, if inflation goes away with that, that would be a good thing. I don't know that we get that. You know, I think a softish recession may not be quite enough to get rid of the inflation. You know, this inflation is now really sticky. You know, it's spread across the economy. And so my scenario is that, if the Fed is too gentle, it will not get rid of inflation. You know, we get a softish landing, but the inflation is still there. And then it just keeps going, you know. And so I think the scenario long term, it could be a lot more muddled than that.
Okay. All right. So first off, 1,000% agree with you about the the role that recessions are supposed to play. And we've had these central planners that, I don't know, starting about late 90s or whatever, just decided that recessions were bad and we should just try to never have them. And we've used the forestry management analogy a ton right here. And you want to let parts of the forest burn occasionally so that too much dry tinder doesn't build up and you have these really damaging forest fires. So we have been preventing that for a long time. And so my question to you is there a chance that in trying to engineer the soft landing, the Fed ignites enough of the excessive pile of dry tinder that this thing gets away from the Fed and we end up having a more painful recession, not because the Fed is trying to engineer it to keep inflation down, but just because they light enough of the spark that this whole thing begins to go?
Yeah, well, there's a chance that could happen. I mean, we could have some kind of catastrophic collapse in the asset markets that would trigger a financial panic like we had during the financial crisis, and everybody stops doing stuff, you know, and the whole economy comes to a halt. I mean, that could happen. I don't see that as a scenario. Yeah, the banks are much better capitalized. They can take much bigger losses. You know, I don't see a sudden collapse in the asset market. I mean, that would be one issue. Another issue would be that, you know, that inflation just doesn't go away, and that the Fed has to keep slugging at it. And at some point, and we went through this in the early 1980s, at some point you get a pretty big recession when that happens, you know, and that will eventually kill inflation. But, and they will reestablish the Fed's credibility as an inflation fighter, which it, you know, it's now got the credibility of an inflation arsonist. Yeah, and so it'll take some doing to get its credibility built up, but without the credibility, you know, inflation is a psychological phenomenon, at least in part, and it requires people to play along with it. You know, if people are going to buy a strike, inflation ends. You know, I mean, yeah, fuel prices, they need to buy fuel, but they drive less. You know, the demand destruction you were mentioning, they switch to their most economical vehicle in the garage. They walk more, they cut out driving vacation. So you get this demand destruction. They switch into cheaper foods. You know, they're not doing the home remodeling. They're doing those kinds of things, you know. So there will eventually be demand destruction. If consumers go on a buyer strike, you know, but that's a psychological thing. You know, that's where the plunge in the asset market comes in. It's not that rich people can't afford to do the $20,000 remodel project. You know, it's that they're not less confident. They're more worried. It's psychological. And so you have, you know, the psychological impact of inflation, and the Fed needs to get on top of that. The Fed needs to say, we have lots of credibility as inflation fighter, and we're going to get this done. And right now, nobody believes the Fed. I mean, you look at all the commentary and it says, well, the Fed's going to cut rates next month, you know, and we're going to have a recession, and look at the bond markets already pricing in the next rate cuts. Yeah, so the credibility of the Fed is completely ruined. You can see that in those comments. Yeah, nobody believes what the Fed said is going to do. Yeah, the markets just say, no, I don't believe that. Yeah, the Fed's going to cut rates by the fall. Yeah, and that is very counterproductive to inflation fight. So my biggest scenario, my most likely scenario, is that the Fed will not be able to get on top of inflation because it's ruined its reputation as inflation fighter, and it will take much longer and much more pain to get this inflation down, and we'll have a mild recession, and there'll be, you know, inflation afterwards, and then, you know, the Fed will have to keep, you know, tightening monetary policy until markets finally believe it. And you know, then hopefully we'll get this inflation down. Okay. But this may take longer.
All right. So I would say still the majority of people that I talk to on this program, they're skeptical of the Fed's backbone here, and they expect, you know, this is exactly what you're saying, right? Yeah. And they expect that, you know, the Fed's going to hike until something breaks, and then the Fed's going to pivot, right? And what I hear you saying is, and of course, anything's possible, but you're saying, you know, the more likely scenario that you see is that the Fed tightens maybe a bit more seriously than people think. It leads us into a soft recession, but it maybe it pauses, or it just doesn't go as tight as it needs to really kill inflation. And we have a couple quarters where the Fed is you know, taking a break for a little bit, but inflation is still persistently high, and then the Fed has to start tightening again. So we kind of have this, I think you used the word muddle through, but we have this sort of muddle through process over quarters, maybe a year or two, who knows. And it will end when the Fed finally gets serious about getting tight enough. Is that true? You're kind of nodding as I'm saying all this.
Yeah, wait, the thing to watch is all your commentators and everybody on Wall Street and all my commenters and my website, yeah, when they agree that the Fed's going to do what it says it will do, then the Fed has credibility. And that is the point in time when the Fed can get inflation under control. As long as everybody says the Fed is just, now I'm not going to do this, they're going to change their mind as soon as the S&P drops, yeah, by X percent, and they're going to cut rates later this year, you know, and et cetera, yeah. When the Fed doesn't have credibility in the market, and that's what this shows, and I get these comments, you get the comments, you know, we read them everywhere. As long as the Fed doesn't have credibility, this inflation doesn't go away. You know, I mean, the Fed totally blew it, and yeah, it's going to be a long time to persuade everybody that the Fed is really serious about inflation. And it, yeah, until everybody switches their thinking over to believe the Fed, yeah, I think this inflation will stay high.
All right. And you know what's not helping that is Bernanke just came out and basically threw the Powell Fed under the bus and said that they waited too long to start hiking. So, you know, even when a recent past Fed chair, you know, starts undermining.
I'm glad he came out and said that, you know, I mean, even Powell said that. And I mean, that's and now there's some acknowledgement at the Fed, you know, so they're making minor steps to repairing the reputation, but
yeah. And it's I'm sure everyone would say too little, too late. I want to go into housing in just a second here, but I, it, just so you know, I did interview a guy from the Dallas Fed last week. Actually, I'll put up a link to it right here for folks that haven't seen it, because the Dallas Fed put out a report a few weeks ago, basically admitting that there's a housing bubble, and I was not only shocked that they wrote that in a report, but that they were willing to let one of the researchers who put the report together come on and be interviewed publicly by me. So they certainly do seem to be taking a more, you know, intentional slant now to acknowledge some of the sins of the past. I mean, I think people who watch that video is really fascinating, but you know, you can see the awkward position that the speaker was in, that you could tell he sort of probably wanted to speak his mind a little bit more than he was being allowed to. But even the fact that he could say what he did, I thought was a pretty interesting sign of the times.
Does he still have a job?
I don't know. We'll find out. I hope so. I'd feel terrible if he didn't come in. But I went through their media relations department, so it's not like he went rogue. All right. I want to get to housing, but one last question for you here. Two last questions for you here. Maybe even three. But I'll just ask for quick answers. So we're all focused on inflation right now. But listening to your comments, and this is what I believe as well, is I think the theme of the year is going to be disinflation, right? Is we're going to be seeing this demand destruction, you know, begin to slowly bite. We already saw reported CPI come down month after month. Was last month the peak? Or sorry, was March the peak? I don't know. We'll find out for sure. But it seems like while inflation will remain persistently high, its rate of increase does seem like it's going to be slowing going forward. Do you agree?
Well, so what we're seeing is inflation in goods coming down. So used car prices, they're still up 22% year over year, you know, but on a month-to-month basis, they came down. But new vehicle, so these are big items.
Big ticket items.
In the CPI. You know? And new vehicle prices month-to-month rose again, you know, so that hasn't turned around yet. We've seen some other goods coming down a little bit. Some of the energy segments came down. That's April. Yeah, since then that has reversed. Gasoline was back up, you know. So some of the decline in gasoline prices that we saw in April will be reversed when we get the May data. And but yeah, so we have this fluctuations in the goods segment. What isn't fluctuating, what is going straight to the sky, is services inflation. And services is as housing costs, but also hotels and airfares and healthcare, and you know, these are double digits. So outside of housing costs, you know, the CPI for hotels, healthcare, rental cars, all these major service items, you know, they're increasing by the double digits now year over year, and there's no slowdown. There's huge demand for these services. And, you know, so the services CPI is now around 5.5%. That's the highest since 91, and it's going straight up. You know, it's just spiking. And so the durable goods and non-durable goods CPIs will come down a little bit, probably, but the services CPI will continue to rise. And so we'll see overall inflation fluctuate a little bit as it gets bounced around between these two elements. And you know, yeah, it'll come down a little bit as services inflation is still relatively low. You know, it's 5.5%, so that's below the CPI. So it's really actually holding down CPI. And but it's spiking, it's going up. You know, so you know, as services CPI takes a bigger role, it will push up overall CPI. Whereas, you know, the goods segments will kind of push it down a little bit. And so we see that kind of up and down. And you know, we might see CPI drop to 7% and then go back to 9%. You know, it when you look at the long-term charts, that's what it did in the 1970s and early 1980s. You know, it went up and then went down and then it went higher. And you know, it's not a straight line. And I think we will get thrown a lot of deceptive data points on the decline, and then a quarter later or a few months later, it'll go back up because, you know, some other element comes to the foreground. And so I call it the inflation whack-a-mole. You know, part of some of it goes down while something else pops up. And we're seeing that. We're seeing that throughout the economy. You know, some prices are falling and other prices are surging. And it, depending on the balance and the overall thing. So I don't think it's a, disinflation is a clear-cut thing for this year. I think we will see ups and downs. We will see, you know, data points that say, oh, this is good. It's really going in the right direction. And then a little while later, it's like, holy Moses, how did we get there? You know, this is really bad.
All right. So it sounds like you're saying chop. You really just sort of expect a lot of chop kind of at this level for the rest of the year. Okay. Last question is on this is just China. You know, in the past, when the world has gotten into trouble, because obviously when the U.S. slows down, it's usually not happening in isolation. A lot of other countries are having similar issues. You know, in the past, China has levered up to really help the world economy out. And I think you can make a pretty good argument that they're not in a position to do that the same way this time around. How much does that weigh on your outlook?
Well, as far as the U.S. economy is concerned, you know, the big issue there are the supply chains. And, you know, that's when you talk to people that are sourcing their components out of China, yeah, it's catastrophic with the new lockdowns, especially. So that's an issue. That's an issue for everybody in the world, you know, because China is, the supply chains just happen to go through China. And, and so that's an issue. The slowdown in China right now, of course, is consumer spending. It's way down in China. Retail spending, you know, during lockdown. There's China imports some of the stuff that the Chinese consumers are buying. So you'll see that. They don't import much from the United States. So I don't really see that impacting us a lot. When China stimulated its economy during the financial crisis, it brought in a lot of economic activity, and a lot of U.S. companies settled over there, including GM and those bankrupt automakers, you know, set up and component makers set up design centers and manufacturing plants, all kinds of things over there. Yeah, that helped the Chinese economy, didn't help the United States economy. So that wasn't, in terms of the global GDP, you know, that doesn't really matter to me. Sure, it's as an American, you know, I mean, you look at it and you say, okay, but we're a net importer, you know, we import a lot more than we export. So we're a lot more, we're not really dependent on global demand, you know, we're much more dependent on global supply. And so I'm not too worried about the Chinese economy slowing down in terms of the US economy. I'm really worried about the supply chains. I mean, that could really trip everything up and it could throw the United States in a recession just because there's not enough supply. And it you know, to cause serious issues in the economy. And I mean, that and things like steel and other things, you know, I mean, it could have all kinds of ramifications if that drags out, you know.
Right. And sorry to interrupt, but that's all outside of the central bank's control, right?
That's correct.
And powerless to do anything about that, right?
Well, they could lower demand. And so when they lower demand, in the United States, it will alleviate pressure on the supply chains.
Right, right. But he can't conjure up any more of this stuff.
No, but they can't increase the supply, but they can decrease the demand.
Right, and that's what he said. That's the only lever he has, and he is committed to pulling that as hard as he can right now. Okay. All right. So let's transition to another one of your recent reports titled "Housing Bubble Getting Ready to Pop." You do a great job creating a lot of wonderful charts. I just want to mention a couple here. One is, mortgage rates are skyrocketing. This chart you're showing actually has lagging data. It's the 30-year average fixed mortgage. It's now up around 5.64%, so even higher than this chart shows. But you can see the trajectory of this chart, right? I mean, mortgage rates have pretty much doubled since last August. That has led, because mortgages are becoming more expensive, that's led to a pretty noticeable decrease in mortgage applications. So they're really beginning to fall off here. At the same time, and you mentioned this earlier, we're seeing refis dry up too, right? And you know, that was a not immaterial, you know, those in home equity loans, you know, those weren't immaterial in terms of, you know, driving consumer spending over the past 10 years or so, right? Because people could kind of use their home as a little bit of like an ATM, right? And they would just count on the appreciation of the home, kind of paying off this loan for them for free. That seems to be ending here. So you have this report that you put out pretty frequently that you call the splendid bubble markets, where you dial through a number of major metros in the US and show how home prices they're doing there. And, you know, it's crazy. I mean, you look at this Case-Shiller data for these markets, and it's just absolutely exponential. And in many cases, it's leaving the prior peak of, you know, 2007 way in the rearview mirror in a lot of these markets here. The latest data you have still doesn't really, it's not updated yet for what's happened with mortgage rates. So I guess my question is, are we sort of like standing on the edge of the cliff here, you know, just waiting to tip over in the housing market?
Yeah. The Case-Shiller data you mentioned, that lags 4 or 5 months. People get, when they apply for mortgage, they get a rate lock, so they get the mortgage rate guaranteed for a while. And so the data, the housing price data that we're looking in the Case-Shiller is based on mortgage rates from late last year. And so we will have to be very patient to see the housing market turn around in the Case-Shiller index. You know, that's going to take a long time because it lags so far, and housing markets in general are very slow. And prices are the last thing to correct in the housing market. You know, first, the volume goes, and some of the underlying dynamics go. We've already seen home sales go down. Existing home sales went down. New house sales went down quite a bit. So, you know, so volume is declining. And that's still based on mortgage rates that were guaranteed, you know, several months ago. So if you get a mortgage today, you get a mortgage rate that's guaranteed at whatever rate you can get today. And then you've got, you know, 3 months or whatever to buy a house with that mortgage that you've got. And so, you know, so that the next 3 months in volume will show us roughly next 4 months, maybe the impact of today's mortgage rates on volume. And what happens is you're taking at a 5.5% mortgage rates, you're taking a substantial layer of buyers out of the market that can no longer afford to buy at these prices that have spiked to these ridiculous levels. And so you'll, with each increase in mortgage rates, you take more buyers out of the market. And at some point, you're going to run out of buyers if you try to sell a home. And, you know, so it sits on the market. And then after a few weeks on the market, you pull it and then you sell it. You try to sell it again, you know. And the last thing you're going to do is lower the price. So, you know, we will see, the mortgage market slow down. We will see the sales slow down. We've already seen the mortgage market slow down. I mean, there've been lots of layoffs in the mortgage industry already. That's already happening. And so, you know, when we had the housing bust in 2000, starting 2005, 2006, you know, and going into 2011, 2012, the first year of that housing bust, we didn't even know we had a housing bust. You know, it was that slow, you know. And now looking back, we see, yeah, with the underlying dynamics told us, but, you know, and the data is slow and the housing market moves slowly. And so that's when it happened, you know. So if we're in the middle of it, we won't see it. You know, we'll see it afterwards, but we won't see it in the middle of it. And, you know, the pricing data we've already seen in Canada, you know, they're a little bit ahead of us. The pricing data is coming down on Canada. So the in April, we just got the numbers for that. The more immediate measures that they have. I expect that we will see the first price declines, not in the Case-Shiller index, but in some of the median price indices that we look at, crop up over the next few months. You cannot have these kind of home price spikes as mortgage rates essentially increase by 2 percentage points. I mean, that's not sustainable. You're shutting down the market. The market freezes, you know, your volume drops. And if you have to sell a house, you're going to have to cut the price to where somebody can afford it. And eventually we'll see that.
All right. And, you know, we have I don't want to go into it deep here because I've gone into it deep in past videos on housing. Actually, a great one, folks, with Nick Jerley. So if you're interested in the housing market and what's going to happen there, go watch that video. I'll link to it here. You know, we have factors like boomers have not, as they've downsized to a smaller home, they've not sold the old home because it was appreciating. They were treating it like a stock, basically. So they were renting it out or Airbnb-ing it or whatnot. You've had a lot of people, a lot more residential housing is now being bought by investors, and biggest class of which are now institutional investors that are buying, in some cases, you know, thousands of these units. So you have inventory that possibly, you know, if the markets start coming down, could be dumped, you know, sooner than later, right? So a second home, it's one of the first things you can dump because you don't need it. And some of these institutions, if one of them gets into trouble and can't find another institution willing just to buy that block, they may flood a market with a bunch of inventory. So there's additional risk factors that maybe we didn't have as much back in the 2007 bubble bursting for housing. So real quick, because I want to get to the financial markets. You say you think we're going to start seeing prices come down in the data over the next, I'll say, quarter or two. When do you think we'll kind of be at the full effect of seeing the full brunt of a housing market price correction? And given the data that you can see right now, and you can totally change it as more data comes in later on, how big of a decline do you see out here on average?
Well, the way I looked at it...
This interview with Wolf will continue over in part two, which will be released on this channel tomorrow as soon as we're finished editing it. To be notified when it comes out, subscribe to this channel if you haven't already by clicking on the subscribe button below, as well as the little bell icon right next to it. And be sure to hit the like button too while you're down there. And last, if the volatile market outlook that Wolf has detailed in this interview has you feeling a little vulnerable about the prospects for your nest egg, then consider scheduling a free, no strings attached portfolio review by a financial advisor who can help manage your wealth, keeping in mind the trends and risks that Wolf's mentioned here. Just go to wealthion.com and we'll help set one up for you. Okay, I'll see you next in part two of our video interview with Wolf Richter.